Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, bringing us the news, maybe bringing us the odd question or two. You did indulge last night in some vegan brunch for dinner.
And I'll be bringing the funk, too.
Today we're going to be talking about vegan brunch. And it's actually a cookbook by that name, Vegan Brunch, by Isa Chandra Moskowitz, who we've had on the program a number of times. And if you are somebody who's interested in vegetarian and vegan cooking, you probably heard her name quite a bit. She's quite famous for books such as Vegan Omicron, which was co-authored with Terry Hope Romero, and also Vegan Cupcakes Take Over the World. And I really think that they did. I think they did take over the world, actually. we're going to be talking, though, today about the book called Vegan Brunch, Homestyle Recipes Worth Waking Up For, From Asparagus Omelets to Pumpkin Pancakes. So we'll do that. We'll do a little Q&A with Isa at about the quarter after point. But before we do that, we're going to hear some news with Carl, and then we'll come back and talk all things waffles, crepes, tofu benny.
Sausages.
Homemade sausages Carl made last night, which were amazing.
Yeah, they were pretty good. I can't take credit for them, though, because it's not my recipe.
It's a funny thing that I've noticed happening lately where people don't want to say, I'm so proud of this thing that I made, because they say, it's not my recipe. I just executed it. But there's more than that to it.
It's kind of like a cover song, you know, doing a cover song. I can't really take credit for the song.
Yeah, but it's how you play it, you know?
I guess so.
How you played that sausage.
Okay.
All right, we're turning over to the news. This is a very serious animal rights program.
Yes. And this is a very serious story. This is coming to us from CBC News. The headline is, Toronto Zoo Elephant Dies After Pushed to Ground by One of Her Own. An elephant died over the weekend at the Toronto Zoo after another elephant shoved her to the ground over some food. Tessa, 40 years old, fell and couldn't get back up, even with the help of a crane, after a more dominant elephant pushed her Saturday, zoo officials said. Quote, we tried to lift her up with the crane, and she put her feet on the ground, but she just wasn't supporting herself, said Eric Cole, supervisor of the African Savanna exhibit. Quote, she just stopped breathing when we put her back down. She died slowly. The breath went out of her, and her heartbeat got dimmer and dimmer, and then she was gone. The elephant, one of the zoo's first animals when it opened in 1974, so you can do the math and see how long she's been there, was a favorite among zookeepers, was weaker than the other members of her group. Her trunk didn't work well, and one of her tusks pointed the wrong way. Her shortcomings made her an easy target for others in the past, though Saturday's accident wasn't about bullying, but about getting food, Cole told the Toronto Star. Zoo caretakers were distraught when Tessa died 3 hours after her fall. Quote, lots of tears, Cole told CBC News on Monday. Everyone's grieving in their own way. This is where the story, I feel, gets a little bit interesting. Even the other elephants mourned. Quote, there was a lot of activity around where Tessa was, Cole said. One elephant, quote, spent a lot of time with the body, throwing some dirt on it, digging around, some of them even sleeping beside her. As for the elephants that pushed Tessa, she stood over the body and wouldn't leave her side. Quote, she was probably thinking, what have I done, Cole said. The veterinary staff at the zoo will conduct an autopsy and then bury her on the grounds near the other elephant graves. Short story coming to us today from earthtimes.org. I really like this story for some reason, and I don't know, maybe it'll be obvious why, but the headline is, Tel Aviv Vegan Bar Bans Israeli Soldiers and Settlement Products. A new Tel Aviv vegan bar run by anarchists bans products made in the settlements in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and denies entry to Israeli soldiers in uniform, the Haaretz Daily reported Sunday. The bar does not seek to make a profit, and its founders, a quote-unquote anarchist collective, say they hope it will bring together left-wing activists, environmentalists, and other such folk under the banner of cheap drinks and fair trade products. The report said the establishment's ban on soldiers in uniform and the carrying of weapons, along with its boycott on products made in the settlements, stems from what employees see as the connection between all forms of oppression, from the slaughter of animals to sexism and occupation. Quote, we can't hold views against discrimination and oppression while at the same time supporting the infrastructure that exploits human beings and other animals. Haaretz quoted Adi Vittner, one of the bar's founders, as saying, quote, we wanted to show it's possible and even worthwhile to live differently, he said. And the next story coming to us from the EdmontonSun.com. The headline is, Animal Rights Group Rallies for Lucy the Elephant. A local animal rights group rallied at the Valley Zoo this morning to raise awareness about the well-being of Lucy the elephant and to mark the first International Day of Action for Elephants in Zoos. The Edmonton-based Voice for Animals group claims that the 32-year-old elephant and Valley Zoo favorite is suffering from various health issues, including arthritis, dental and respiratory problems, and should be moved to a sanctuary to roam free with other elephants. Quote, "Lucy looks unhappy," said group spokesman Tove Reese. "This is our ongoing campaign to put pressure on the zoo and on the city to have Lucy moved." Reese said two elephant sanctuaries in the U.S. have offered a place for Lucy and to send their veterinarians to examine her. Reese has been in touch with zoo officials over the years, but they refuse to move Lucy because she is a quote-unquote cause celeb for the zoo's fundraising efforts, she added. About 10 ralliers and the group's elephant mascot stood at the entrance of the zoo waving signs that read, "Set Lucy Free," as participants for the memory walk strolled past. Some walk participants waved while vehicles passed by, honked in support, but others rebuked the group for demonstrating during the event, which raises money for Alzheimer's disease. Quote, "This is not the time and the place to be doing this," one woman said angrily when a demonstrator offered her a pamphlet. Other organizations, as well as a few celebrities, have fought hard to rescue Lucy over the years. In May, a group of Canadian authors, including well-known names like Margaret Atwood and Michael Ondaatje, sent a letter to City Council urging them to move the elephant. And in February, former Price is Right game show host Bob Barker reached out to Council to pressure them into sending Lucy to a sanctuary. But zoo officials and city councilors have maintained that Lucy is doing well and is well taken care of where she is. In fact, she would die in transit if she removed because of her malpositioned molar, Valley Zoo Operations Supervisor Dean Treichel has said in February. Across the world, activists staged similar protests. A small group of people stood outside the Toronto Zoo waving signs, reading "Elephants suffer in zoos," just a week after Tessa, a 40-year-old elephant, died after being shoved by a dominant member of her group who wanted to steal her food. And the final story today coming to us from longislandpress.com. The headline is "Animal Rights Activists Protest Shark Tournament." With the 23rd annual Star Island Yacht Club Shark Tournament in Montauk, a much-anticipated event within the Long Island fishing community that runs June 18th to June 20th, animal rights activists are protesting to stop the event. The Humane Society of the United States and Fishpond USA, a major recreational fishing product company, strange bedfellows, I guess, are fighting to put an end to the tournament on the grounds of it being detrimental to an already dwindling shark population caused by overfishing on the East Coast. But organizers and participants say that most of the sharks are released and those that aren't are donated to charity to help feed the hungry. At last year's Star Island Yacht Club tournament, more than $760,000 were awarded for the capture of 42 sharks, the biggest being a 353-pound thresher shark caught by 16-year-old John Diggert. Thresher, mako, porbigo sharks, which are frequently targets at shark tournaments, are facing worldwide extinction, according to a 2008 study by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources. Quote, "The Star Island Yacht Club Shark Tournament encourages ecologically damaging practices and exploits sharks in the process by celebrating their deaths with large cash prizes," said John Grandy, vice president of the Humane Society of the United States, in a statement. "We call on the organizers of this event to end this tournament now." The tournament is an elaborate event, starting with the captain's meeting on Thursday, followed by 2 days of fishing and ending with an award ceremony on Saturday featuring free dinner and live music. There is an $800 entry fee per boat. The Yacht Club offers boat rentals and charter captains for those who want to participate in the shark tournament but who do not possess the equipment. According to the tournament's website, more than 400 sharks were released back into the ocean after last year's tournament. Of the sharks that were captured, more than 1,200 pounds of edible shark meat was donated to the Long Island Council of Churches food pantry. Still, those opposed to the tournament cry foul, citing federal reports that advise against the consumption of shark meat by children and pregnant or nursing women due to the risk of mercury contamination. Tournament protesters also accuse the tournament as condoning atrocities against sharks by hanging and weighing them alive and then dismembering them in front of children. Quote, "Shark tournaments are a disgrace to the environment and the community," said John Lecoq, co-founder of Fishpond USA, in a statement. "Montauk should stop playing host to this kind of brutality." Regardless, the tournament is scheduled to go on, offering a $25,000 prize for the heaviest shark in the tournament. And that's all the news for today, but on a slightly, well, actually, a much, much happier note, not just slightly. I wanted to let everyone know about the Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale that is happening right now, actually. It's happening all around the world right now, which is a bit strange. If you go to veganbakesale.org, you can check out the information about the Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale. Essentially, the idea is that people will hold bake sales between June 20th and June 28th. Your bake sale can essentially be for any cause you want it to be, as long as it's a vegan bake sale. You can register on that website, and they'll promote your vegan bake sale for you as well. And they've got a Facebook page and a Twitter page and all the things that seem essential now to be on the web.
to have any kind of event anywhere.
To have any kind of event, you have to be on Twitter and Facebook. So check it out, veganbakesale.org, veganbakesale, all one word, .org. And I think there was a vegan bake sale in Toronto this past weekend, although I only heard vague rumblings about it and didn't get any details. But I want vegan baked goods, so send them to me now.
I think one of the things that's really exciting about the vegan bake sales is that, well, it's a chance to raise money for a good cause of your choosing, but it's also a chance to do some activism with food. And
totally,
if we've learned one thing over the years with this show and all the programs we've done on cooking, is that food, baked goods, really sweet things and decadent things, and just good tasting foods can be a great way of doing outreach about foods that don't contain animal products, and it can really initiate some good conversations about what vegans eat.
Definitely.
It's kind of a solidarity thing, too. I think it's kind of cool that everybody around the world would be doing that. You could kind of have a sense of that.
It'd be cool to have a simultaneous vegan bake sale worldwide.
Start.
Although that would be, like, that would be really, you know, the bake sale in Japan would have to be at, like, midnight or something like that, which is not really practical.
There's some technical issues you need to work out first.
Yeah. I think this is actually a much better way to do it.
Right. Okay. Okay, we're going to take a short break. I think we're in a giddy mood today. I think probably it's because we've got a really good interview coming up with Isa. Chandra Moskowitz, we're going to be talking about her book, Vegan Brunch, Homestyle Recipes Worth Waking Up For, From Asparagus Omelets to Pumpkin Pancakes. This is a book that's gotten a lot of praise. I've been looking around on the internet to see if I could find some criticisms of the book. They must be out there, but I couldn't find any. People are really swooning. There's a couple of more critical questions, I guess, that people sent in that they'd like us to ask Isa, but overall the book has really gotten some incredible accolades. So we're going to come back and find out about how to put on a really good vegan brunch and more about this really wonderful vegan cookbook author. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. You were just listening to a nice little track by a band from this very city of Toronto. They're not around anymore, but they were good while they lasted. They were called Cursed, and the song was called Magic Fingers. We're back.
Do you find that life is like an Animal Voices playlist, Carl? You just never know what you're going to get on the
no,
show.
No, I know exactly what I'm going to get.
I think Isa would be proud of that choice.
Would she? I don't know.
I
Isa,
think so.
Would you be proud of that choice?
Oh, we ever know. Yeah, that was good. Intro music.
Thank you.
You actually do suggest playing some, well, I don't think Curse is hair metal, but you suggest hair metal to kick off, or to get your juices flowing, basically, when you are preparing vegan brunch for your friends.
Yeah, I do. I put on the Faster Pussycat,
yes.
The LA Guns.
Okay, I was going to ask. So I know that you flag Faster Pussycats in the book. And LA Guns wasn't mentioned. Are there any other ones?
I just say hair metal. Any hair metal will do.
And why in particular do you find that really gets you going?
I think because it's kind of funny and also energizing. It's not very serious.
Right.
And you can kind of pretend that you're hitting the high notes. And a good way to entertain yourself.
Yeah. I should say, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you back on. We're talking about your book.
Ah, Behind My Back.
Yeah, we were, basically. We're talking about vegan brunch today, just for people who are tuning in. Vegan brunch, homestyle recipes worth waking up for, from asparagus omelets to pumpkin pancakes. And we're speaking with Isa Chandra Moskowitz, who is the author of many best-selling cookbooks. Some of them that you might know are Vegan Omicron and Vegan Cupcakes Take Over the World, Vegan with a Vengeance, and...
And Your Mom...
Okay. And then there's the cookie one, the vegan cookies invade your cookie jar?
Yeah, invading your cookie jar.
Invading your cookie jar. When we've had you on the program before, I know that we've kind of recovered from this original position, but when we had you on a while ago with Vegan Cupcakes Take Over the World, you were really sick of talking about vegan cupcakes at that point. And I felt though with this book that you probably weren't sick of vegan brunch yet.
No, I don't think that's gonna happen. I think the vegan cupcakes was just so adorable.
Yeah.
And everything else kind of fell by the wayside. With brunch, you've got your variety.
Yeah.
And your cooking kind of stuff.
So tell us about vegan brunch. I really like how you talk about why you particularly like brunch and how you find it brings people together. But if you could riff on brunch a little bit and why you like this meal, that would be
great. Can I just read right out of the book?
Yeah, sure.
I'm not really going to do that.
Okay.
Well, let's see. I think it is an event for most people. It's not just eating. Like, people are like, what's the difference between breakfast and brunch? But breakfast is whatever you're eating. Like, it doesn't matter. It could be cereal. Brunch can't be cereal. You know, it's like a thing. You're getting a bunch of people together and you're doing something special and you have more time to cook. That's why I love it. It always kind of just sets the weekend right, if it's Saturday or Sunday. Like Sunday, it's kind of a nice lazy day. Saturday, your weekend's just beginning.
Mm.
And I just love the foods that we have at brunch traditionally.
And those were some of the things that I guess a lot of vegans who've maybe been vegan for a while or just gone vegan, a lot of the brunch foods aren't necessarily readily available in terms of recipes out there that might give you those traditional flavors but without the animal products.
Right. Yeah, there's always, of course, like tofu omelets and scrambles and stuff. These are just my favorite takes on them. I think with French toast, it was really fun exploring different kinds of, like, I don't have to try and just make plain old French toast, which I did with Vegan with a Vengeance anyway. Like, I got to try banana French toast and pumpkin French toast and just trying different flavors. So I guess there was some of these kinds of recipes out there. Hopefully I'm adding to your repertoire with it, though.
Yeah, so there really isn't a vegan brunch cookbook, though, specifically just for this, is there?
Yeah, no, not that I know of. Nope.
Nice. Pioneering work by Issa.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like a lot of your quotes. It's a really fun book just to read through in general. And one of the things that I found, too, and I don't know if we've touched on this before, but one of the things I really like about your style as a cookbook author, and it also makes me a little bit concerned for vegans, though, out there, and just people in general, is that you really comfort people. Like, don't be afraid, try this. And there's even a letter to a young crepe maker in the middle of the book, which was really fun to read. But there's kind of this underlying idea that sometimes people are pretty intimidated to try to make foods. And I was wondering about your take on that and if that's coming out of your experience with the post-punk kitchen and people writing you that people are worried to take the leap and try new things and how you make sense of that.
Actually, it's from my experience learning to cook, because essentially I learned to cook from cookbooks also. So sometimes I'd look at a recipe and just be like, no way. I mean, I wrote a little bit about waffles. Like, I thought waffles were magic. I didn't realize you can actually make them and that they would actually be good. So once I tried these things, and even if I failed a couple of times, one second.
Okay.
I'm having cat issues.
That's a kind of cute tie-in with the crepes, because there's in your message to the people who are afraid of making crepes, you say, you know, this will help you if you follow these techniques. It will prevent you from dropping your crepe batter onto your cat's head. Has that happened?
Yeah, it happens.
Oh, no!
It does, because you slide the crepe around, you know, it's all wrist action with the crepe. So when it's working, it should be sliding around nicely in your pan. And, you know, if your cat's right there, my cats are always, like, right next to me cooking. If the crepe falls out, yeah, crepe fell onto Fizzle's head.
Mm. Fizzle.
Lots of stuff has fallen onto his head.
Okay.
Okay so far.
Right, but he's doing okay.
Yeah. So yeah, like, I just remembered how it was learning to cook, and I guess that's what I'm talking about when I talk to people like
right.
that. I'm not thinking that they're dumber than me, just maybe less experienced.
Right. It's a letter to yourself in a way, maybe.
Yeah.
I like how in that letter to a young crepe maker, you talk about that if you fail or you screw up a crepe, it's not a big deal, and it doesn't mean that you're a failed human being. But if you never make a crepe because you're afraid, then it does mean that you're a failed person.
It does. I think so. Like, I think that's what's going to be going through your head on your deathbed.
Totally, totally. So we've talked a little bit about crepes. Can you tell us about some of the different variations that are in the book with crepes and some of the other, I guess, crepes walk the line between sweet and savory, depending on which way you go, which is kind of cool.
Well, they play for both teams.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So there's an Ethiopian crepe in there, which is just kind of like how injera with Ethiopian food, you know, that nice,
oh, we know it,
Saki bread.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a take on that, and then for the sweet ones, well, you can do that. There's, I do lots of, like, I would use any of the omelet fillings for the crepes, too. I actually should have said that in the book, but I didn't. And then there's also the sweet crepes, so, which are more like blintzes, which are basically a crepe with, like, stuff with keys or fruit. Mm. So I do this cashew ricotta kind of thing in there with lemon and then berry sauce. And that's the sweet one, blintz-like one. And what else do I do in there? I don't even remember writing the book.
This is a ricotta stuffed one, I think, too.
Or maybe, yeah, that's,
yeah?
Yeah, that's like the blintz kind of
okay,
one.
Okay, right.
Yeah, and I did whole wheat. I tried to use a lot of different flours in the book. Not only because I keep getting Amazon reviews that say that the books are unhealthy.
Oh.
But, no, because a lot of times people don't read the book and realize that I talk about substituting flours and things like that. And it's just kind of easier when you just say all-purpose white flour and then have a section for substituting flours.
Mm.
But I just thought I'd, you know, actually use spells in the recipes, and I used white whole wheat flour. And I think the crepes are whole wheat pastry flour.
You mentioned omelets, too, and I think for a lot of people who are vegan that the omelet is kind of, that's kind of a thing of the past, and so it was interesting to see an omelet in here. What's your technique?
Yeah, so the omelets are something that I've been working on for a long time, probably since I was a teenager, so it was kind of interesting to revisit this recipe that I've just been using that I never really thought was quite good enough for a book. Well, now I do, obviously, or I wouldn't put it in. It was always just kind of this, like, pureed tofu and flour and nutritional yeast, essentially. And for me, it's good. I was like, I like this, but, like, I fed it to people, and they've been like, I don't know. So I worked a lot on the recipe, and I came up with a couple of cool additions to it that made it really yummy. So I started using black salt, which is a sulfuric-tasting salt from India.
Mm-hmm.
And that just makes it taste pretty much exactly like eggs. It's called Kala Namak also, is the Indian name for it. And yeah, you smell it and you immediately think of eggs. So that was great for the flavor. And then I started using chickpea flour instead of regular flour, and that just like elevated it to this great textural point where it's just nice and fluffy. I think using the regular flour was making it kind of gummy, and the chickpea flour, since it's gluten-free, just added the right texture and the right amount of, like, it helps it stay together, but it's still fluffy. So, yeah, that was the story with the omelet.
And then the black salt does end up featuring elsewhere, too. We made the tofu benny last night, and I got on my bike and went down to Little India, which is pretty close to our house, and made my first foray into black salt, which is really interesting because, as you mentioned in the book, it's pink when it's ground.
Yes.
Fine. And I know a lot of people who want to achieve the flavors in these eggy dishes might go to, like, a salt specialty store, but in Little India or someplace like that, you can get, I think I got a bag for, like, $2 or something. Mm-hmm. And it's really amazing stuff.
Yeah, you need to stay away from those, like, expensive salt specialty stores, even though I don't take my own advice and I'll totally go into them. But yeah, so you probably got, like, 4 ounces for $2 or something like that.
Yeah.
And then if you went to a salt store, it would have been, like, $15.
Yeah, and so it's weird because I think sometimes people think, well, because I read a little bit of people talking about, oh, I need to go get this, I need to go get the black salt, and people finding it really daunting, but it was really, really easy to find in Little India. It was like the first store that I went into, they knew exactly what I was talking about, and they had big bags of it, so.
Yeah, when people complain like that, it's just, I don't know where they're going to get in life anyway. Just like, if you don't have the gumption to go out and find assault, what do you have the gumption to go out and do?
Right.
It's like, it's supposed to be like, I wrote about that in the book too, in the front. Like, that's supposed to be a fun part. If you really hate the idea of, like, finding new foods and finding new kinds of markets and, you know, leaving your neighborhood, then maybe brunch for you isn't for you in general.
Right. This is a, these, I guess some of these require a little bit more effort and some forethought.
A couple do.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I try to, I mean, it's brunch, so, like, have a little fun with it, do things you wouldn't normally do, and it's not, like, a quick, you know, 30-minute breakfast kind of thing.
Right, add everything and then puree it, and then you have your shake.
Yeah.
Although just a brunch, like, a shake brunch would be really hilarious, I think.
Yeah, I put it in a little smoothie section, because I thought everybody knew how to make a smoothie, but they don't. So I, you know, added a little drink section.
Yeah, I have mango lassis in there, which I've been wanting to try.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. You kind of mentioned that, too. I mean, you talked about the Ethiopian-inspired, some of the Ethiopian-inspired foods that are in there, and that one of the things that struck me about the book, too, is that while there's sort of traditional North American things that people would consider brunch fare, this is has a lot of diversity, and you tie it back to New York. You say this is the kind of brunch that you can get in New York in this book, which kind of means everything.
Yeah, well, the kind of things people, you're not just eating, you know, what your American grandparents were eating for breakfast. So New York has a lot of ethnic diversity and lots of different people eating different foods. It's not just the white man. So I think that's what, you know, so there's pierogies for breakfast, and dosa, and Ethiopian food, like dim sum is a really traditional breakfast in Japan, but I didn't get to include that. I was doing a dim sum chapter, and I actually just gave up.
Oh.
I was like, you know what, this is not for me, like, I can't do this.
Why, what happened?
Oh, it's just really, really intensive, and to the point where it just, I don't think it would be practical. Like, the stuff that I was doing just wouldn't really be that practical to make for brunch, even though I'm saying go out and try new things. For me, it was just kind of like, oh, like, this is beyond me.
Yeah.
Bigger than me.
I'm expecting, like, in 5 years, it's going to be, like, vegan dim sum by Issa Chandramouli.
Yeah, totally. Well, I'd
go away and work on it.
The thing was, I wouldn't mind tackling it. It was just too much for this book, and I was like, I needed to scale back a little bit from my ambitions.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things that you weren't able to include, but we need to take a short break. We'll play an ad, and then we'll come back. Hi, welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. I should let people know, if you want to contact us, we'd love to hear from you. You can write us at animalvoices, all one word, animalvoices@gmail.com. You can go to our website, animalvoices.ca, and check out about 300 of our shows that are available as an archive for free download on that website as well. And this program will be archived within about a week. Today we're speaking with Issa Chandra Moskowitz. We're talking about her new book, very new, out with DeCapo Press, and the book is called Vegan Brunch, Homestyle Recipes Worth Waking Up For, from Asparagus Omelets to Pumpkin Pancakes. And before the break, I was going to ask Issa about some of the things that you weren't able to include, and you mentioned dim sum because it was a bit overwhelming and a bit daunting, but was there other things that you felt that you weren't able to include that you kind of wanted to?
I'm sure there were, and I'm trying to think of anything besides dim sum, and I can't exactly. The pierogi almost didn't make it, but it did. Let's see.
Why was there a question mark around the pierogi?
Because sometimes I make dough and I throw a hissy fit, and I'm like, I'm not putting any dough in this book.
Because it's temperamental?
Yeah, I'm temperamental.
You're temperamental.
Like stuffing things sometimes, I get really pissed off when I have to stuff things. So, there was a couple of things, a tamale that didn't make it. Some things just don't make it.
The tamale didn't make it.
Tamale that never made it, which is cool because Terry is doing a Latina book.
Yeah.
So that's going to be in there. But some of those things don't make it just because I forget to put them in the manuscript also. So, yeah, lots of lots of ways a recipe cannot make it in.
We're glad about the pierogi that it made it in. Carl is Polish.
I was super stoked to see that.
His eyes lit up.
I didn't realize that pierogies were a brunch food. I've always eaten them.
Yeah.
Well, totally. I've eaten them actually every meal of the day, but I've never had them at a brunch, so I was pretty stoked on that.
Yeah,
well, it's pretty common in New York to just go to one of those Polish diners. The thing is, the one that wasn't using, like a lot of the ones that were not using eggs in their pierogi closed, and ones that weren't using eggs started using eggs. So I don't know which pierogi are vegan in New York right now.
Mm. Do you think it was a conspiracy?
Like I do. Yeah.
The egg lobby.
Yeah, I don't get why they do that. Like to add such a common allergen. Or something that's more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It's really weird. But luckily, the knishes are still vegan.
Nice.
Good to know.
You know, I've never been to New York, and I have a couple of friends. I know it's really bad. A couple of my friends are moving there this year, and so I'm going to go, and I'm really excited.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have a great time, like, just eating.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. A friend of mine who isn't vegan said to me the other day, because I was saying, "Oh, you should go. There's a new vegan soul food kitchen called One Love Vegetarian, by the way, in Toronto." And I had just gone, and they have amazing rotis. And I was talking to my friend who isn't vegan, and he said, kind of out of the blue, he said, "You really like food, don't you?" And I was like, you know, vegans are weird that way. Like, it can be really boring to get together with a group of vegans. So talk about like cats, Scrabble, and food.
Yeah.
And pretty much that.
You just described my entire life, except you didn't say couch.
So, Carl, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation, though, because one of the things that we made last night, and one of the things that features in the cookbook, I think as a highlight, is the sausages. And I was saying to friends of ours that we fed this to you last night, that I think making your own fake meat is actually kind of empowering, and the sausages...
Yeah.
Empowering. Because you think of it as like a thing that you would just buy at the store.
I agree. I love when stuff like that happens.
Yeah.
My friend Julie Hassan came up with the method of steaming them. Because, you know, there's always these like tinfoil, Tootsie Roll tubes of sausages floating around on the internet. They're usually baked. So she had the bright idea to be like, let's see what happens if you steam them. And it turns out they become really nice and tender.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And juicy and just like more like the store-bought kind of vegan sausages to buy. So yeah, I like went to town with that.
And you have all these different variations that you can do. Carl, you made them for the first time yesterday.
Yeah, that was the first time I had ever made a vegan sausage, and I made the chorizo kind. And I was really impressed. I will admit, and this is not to say that I doubted you, Issa, but I went into it thinking there's no way these are going to be as good as the store-bought kind, and I would say that they're actually just as good, if not better.
I know. It's crazy.
I was skeptical,
too. Like, I don't...
It was the steaming that got... I was like, there's no way you can't steam a sausage.
You can't steam a sausage. Come on. It can't happen. It can't be. And the thing is, I think it's intimidating to think you have to do something kind of crafty, like wrapping these sausages up, but it's so simple.
It was so simple, yeah.
Even the biggest skeptic, if you're doubting this, you have to try it.
I'm a good barometer too. If I can make something and it turns out successful, then I think it's a fairly easy recipe, and this was simple.
And the best part is how fast it is too.
Totally.
You don't have to be like all fussy to make it the right shape. It just is magic and becomes the right shape for you.
The only thing that we were thinking is yesterday was one of the really first hot days in Toronto, and we were like, why are we steaming this at 5 in the afternoon?
Yeah.
So we were kind of laughing at ourselves. We had some people who wrote us in questions. I don't know if we'll get to all of them, but I thought we could maybe go over some of them. And some are specifically about Vegan Brunch, your book, and some of them are just more general about...
Like why I'm so pretty and stuff like
Yeah,
that.
How okay. You got so hot, and where did you get the amazing blue headband, which I really like on the cover. It's a great headband.
Yeah, you know, I don't know where it went. I should auction it off for charity.
Somebody
probably stole it, an adoring fan.
Okay, so here's one from Giselle. And this is just a general question. And she says, when I make pancakes, they usually turn out fluffy and great, but a few times they turn out more like mushy crepes. I think I'm following the recipe exactly each time. What could be going wrong? Old baking soda or something? Thanks, Giselle.
Yeah, it could be a baking powder, baking soda situation. It could be... Flour is really temperamental, especially flour and heat. So it could be something like it's too humid out. It could be the heat is, you know, your oven's at the wrong, your stovetop's at the wrong temperature. But if I'm having super watery pancakes, which does happen, like I don't get it right the first time every single time, then I'll add a little bit more baking powder and a little bit more flour and see what happens. And I'll adjust the heat. Usually if it's flat like that, your heat might be a little bit too low.
Right.
Yeah, all of those things.
You said that the baking soda or baking powder could be the issue. Do those things have a shelf life? Can they go bad?
They do have a shelf life, and sometimes I've gotten ones from the store that are just dead.
Oh.
That's been really, really rare. But yeah, I don't know exactly what the shelf life is, honestly. I think if it's getting dusty, it's time to get a new container. Or
right.
Start baking a lot more.
I dust mine every day, so that would never happen to me.
I have somebody that comes in and dusts all my baking powder.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's important.
I was just thinking, okay, so maybe if it starts clumping together, that might be a good time to get a new baking powder. Or if your mom is like, oh, I remember I got this baking powder for you to make cupcakes for Ronald Reagan's inauguration.
Yeah.
Then it's time to get new.
It's a sign. Mm-hmm. This is another question.
Oh, I just realized I can do a Jeff Foxworthy kind of comedy with that. Then it might be time for new baking powder. Okay, I'll shut up.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, the point is that we're talking to you, so the more of you talking is good. Yeah.
No, it's bad for me, but okay.
Okay, so this is from Wendy, and she says, this is a more general question, I guess, for cooks, but as someone who's felt the effects of sugar, including beet sugar and molasses, are there any plans in the works for creating sweet recipes that use rice syrup, barley malt, agave, and or maple syrup in place of those more mood-altering sweeteners? Smiley face.
Why, yeah.
Wendy.
Uh-huh. Actually, I kind of don't eat sugar right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Whoa, breaking news. Or maybe this isn't, I don't know.
It's because mostly, we just wrote the cookie cookbook.
Yeah.
And then I noticed I was breaking out a bit. And, I mean, I know sugar's not that healthy, or not healthy at all, and I'm going to die from eating it and all that, but I was still, but with the cookie book, I kind of, was just eating way too much sugar. And I just wanted to see. I heard that women in their 30s go through a second puberty, so that could be it. But I'm just trying to, lower my sugar intake. So I'm using agave and brown rice syrup most of the time for sweetening things. And also just eating fruit instead of cookies, taking a little break from that.
Mm.
But in our cookie book, we actually have a section called Wholesome Cookies. And that's we actually use no refined sugar. A lot of it's gluten-free. A lot of the cookies are just spelt flour or whole wheat flour, and then different alternative flours. That was really fun to play with, actually, coming up with all these different flavors and textures. And we even have, a carob cookie in there, 21st century carob cookies, paying homage to the 80s health food.
And Terry would be so happy.
Yes. Oh, yeah, we've talked about carob before. We actually got, Terry came out to Portland, and we got to make that one together. So the way we update carob is we use currants.
Oh.
You know, that'll do it. But who the hell knows? Anyway, so yeah, that cookie book has replacements, alternative sweeteners, and we also tell you how to replace stuff.
Okay.
So I think with liquid to dry ingredients, it can be tricky, and you need to have a little bit of experience, but it can be done. I think for cookies, it'll come out a little bit cakier, but...
Mm. Yeah, I think it's interesting you use the word wholesome, because I think a lot of people are really afraid of anything that looks like stereotypical 1960s and 70s, 80s, I guess, vegetarian cooking. And so this isn't going to be like gritty lentil cookies that you're talking about.
Yeah, no. We're trying to make it not. If something comes out like that, we obviously don't put it in. But I think we talked about this before too. Is that I do have a taste for 70s, 80s health food.
Right.
So I'll eat me some gritty cookies.
I know, and I'm always beating up on the lentil, but really, I'm a secret lentil lover.
Oh, I love lentils. But yeah, we're going for mainstream kind of flavors and textures, you know, even if they're a little bit different, we're trying not to make it. None of the cookies are health foody tasting.
Mm.
There's a couple of breakfast cookies which was supposed to be like less sweet and more healthy tasting, but not in a, you know, overwhelming kind of way. So yeah, that's our wholesome section. And then there's a cupcake in vegan cupcakes that's agave sweetened. And so you can just kind of have a field day with that in terms of like changing the flavors around. You know, use different extracts, kind of look through the other book and get ideas and use that recipe as a base.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
It'd be fun if one day you do like a retro cookbook, you know, for like that inner 1970s vegetarian in you. And it could be like the first chapter is just like loaves.
Yes, totally, loaves. Like walnut lentil loaf.
Carl and I were looking at some old, like even not that old, like early 1990s vegetarian magazines, and they were super creepy, and I was trying to figure out, like, why are they so creepy? And it's because there's been this shift, I don't know if you've noticed this, towards, with the photography, Carl pointed this out, that there's, in the magazines now, they'll tend to focus, like, macro shots on food, but this was all about, like, setting the scene, so they had, like, a New Orleans stew that you could do, and then there was a weird little clown in the side, and then there was, like, a trumpet over there.
And the bird's eye view.
Yeah.
And the buffet table. Yeah, somewhere along the lines, the tablescape kind of fell out of fashion.
Yeah.
So, yeah, also with food photography, the quality of the photography has improved so much of what you can print, like the actual prints.
Yeah.
The printing looks different, so.
And that's actually something I've read before that you're quite passionate about, that if you're going to post pictures of your vegan delights that you've made, to make sure that the picture is a good one.
Yeah, a lot of people are into their cell phone picture, which kind of, you know, low light cell phone with a flash kind of food photography, and that just, no matter what the food is, I mean, you can be sitting in Millennium and take a picture, and it's going to look like the waitress just threw up on your plate. So now no one's ever going to want to eat again. Yeah, I think people just need to like be a little bit more aware of the kind of food photography they're putting out there.
Yeah,
and if it doesn't look good, you don't need to post it.
Yeah.
It's funny, though, because I have a section on my board for food porn, and sometimes, you know, someone will post, like, a half-eaten piece of pizza with, like, a shred of lettuce next to it, and, like, you know how gross food looks, how can look after, you know, you've eaten half of it?
Mm-hmm.
And people will actually still be like, yum, that looks great, I'm drooling. So I think vegans are really polite, nice people.
Maybe they have a thing about eating half-eaten food.
That's true, maybe it's, like, this, like, sick eating fetish.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the strengths of your cookbooks and your approach, is that there's an underlying advocacy kind of tone to everything that isn't like in your face or anything like that, but there's always a sense that you could be potentially serving food or making food for somebody who's really new to veganism and maybe is a little bit afraid of vegan food or what that's going to look like. And so there's a sort of sense like, you know, make sure that the presentation is as good if you can and make really good food, because this can be an opportunity to kind of introduce somebody to something that is actually less harmful to animals, obviously, to you, to the planet, is something that you point out in your book.
Right, because we're always repping veganism. And before I moved to Portland, I used to hang out with non-vegans all the time. I swear, I don't know any non-vegans in Portland.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, like, it's good to just kind of have it together and just, like, be a positive representation. But did you know I'm starting a cooking school?
I did. This is actually one of the questions.
Oh, okay.
It sort of leads into it.
Wait for it.
Okay, well, we could go for it now. It says, question... Isa, congratulations on opening your new cooking school space. 3! If you could have one band play at your place for opening night, what would it be? And that's from Dylan from the Vegan Police.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I can have one band play. Oh, man.
I'm
thinking for me, Crass.
Ooh.
but is that what the kids want to see? Probably, actually.
Yeah.
I guess more realistically, well, not that Ted Leo would do it, but that would be kind of awesome.
Cool.
I never even thought of having bands play there, honestly.
Huh. You had them in your living room, though.
I know. I didn't think... The thing is, this all happened really fast.
Okay,
like,
so what...
I've only been working on this for a week and a half.
Okay.
So it's really funny. Like, there's a lot of things I haven't had a chance to think about, but...
So what is going on?
so I got this amazing space that I was just looking at apartments, and I told my landlord, you know, what I did. You know, he was showing me, like, this electric stove, and I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm a celebrity chef, so I need a good stove. And then he was like, oh, well, I just rented this place, and it's really awesome. Do you want to just go look at it for kicks? And I was like, sure, which is really masochistic, because it turned out being this, like, amazing space with, like, a big commercial kitchen and a big open space. And, you know, my mind just started reeling over what I could do in there, like cooking school and do these food events and brunches. But, of course, it was taken. So, long story short, whenever I went to New York, and I was working at, actually, Woodstock Farm Sanctuary last weekend for the June Jamboree thingy I was cooking, and then I got this email at, like, 7 in the morning that was, like, the space is yours, kind of out of the blue.
Whoa.
Yeah, so I freaked out. And
You sound so excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, it's just insane, and everybody's like, how long were you planning on doing this? Why didn't you tell me? But I wasn't planning on doing this. It's just, it happened. Like, the space came up. Like, I wasn't like, oh, I want a cooking school. I saw the space, and then I realized what could be done with it, and then I kind of thought of what, you know, it just ended up being this thing that, it's perfect for me, because I, like, I don't want a restaurant. That's just too much. That's like having kids, and I'm still, you know, I want to have a life. So it's good, because I can do that on the weekends. Plus, I really like teaching how to cook. And what this is going to do, I think, is it's an opportunity to do a lot of vegan outreach instead of just catering to vegans. Like, I want to work with social programs to show people how to cook for cheap, and it just happens to be vegan, you know. And so doing these scholarships and helping low-income families learn how to cook with lentils. Like, you don't need, you know, the meat to go on sale. You can use lentils and grains and things like that. So hopefully, what it's going to, like, it's going to be really fun for vegans, too, because I'll have these cooking classes and brunches, and I'm having tapas night on Friday, and I'm having Sundays on Saturdays. But during the week, I really want to be doing outreach kind of stuff and, like, bringing in non-vegans to learn how to do all this stuff, because, like, veganism really is going to save the world, I think, and we need as much opportunity to show people what it's about, that it's not, like not an AR conference. Most new vegans don't walk into an AR conference, you know?
Mm.
So something like making soup is very approachable and fun. So, yeah, that's the cooking school. And then I'm going to have just, you know, classes during the week of crepe making, waffle making, sushi rolling, knife skills, probably do a lot of root veggie stuff because that's my favorite kind of thing to do. I just thought, I'm still working on the list of classes. I'm, like, doing a gazillion things because I also still have to write the business plan. I have to move. So, yeah,
That sounds great. You said that you really do believe that veganism is going to save the world. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Like, how, why you believe so much in this? I mean, you really, I know people say, you're the new face of veganism, but you kind of are. And so you're...
I'm the old new face.
You're the old new face. So why do you believe in this so much?
Well, I became vegan because I loved animals kind of thing. But it just so happens we have this great opportunity in that the world is ending. So there's also, like, that was kind of a joke. But for the environment...
I try not to snort into the mic, so when you're making these jokes, I don't want to be like, oh. But anyway, I am smiling.
So just, I think a lot of people are becoming environmentalists and just kind of realizing Earth's limited resources and what's happening to... You know, environmental devastation. Doesn't that make me sound like a great advocate? Don't worry, I don't talk like that to people when I'm explaining these kinds of things.
Great.
But just everything about veganism is what's going to help. Like, it's funny because we have all, like, omnivore's dilemma and all that stuff, and it's good because I think it gives people, like, a starting point and kind of an awareness and lights a spark that a vegan might otherwise not. But the answer is always, it's never a veganism to them, but I think it's going to start being that way just because of the tipping point's been reached.
Mm.
So I think literally, I think the most important thing right now is focusing on the environmental stuff, because if we don't have an Earth, there won't be a veganism. Well, there will be, but it's because everybody's going to be dead. So,
am I supposed? I don't know to laugh at something like that or not, but right. I guess I am.
I think it's appropriate.
We actually have an environmental related question.
Oh no.
in the questions that people did send in, because I find this a challenge myself, and it sounds like you get a lot of praise for your work, but then there's a lot of people that kind of nitpick, and maybe those are valid some of the times and maybe they're not. I'm not sure always, but there's a question here about cornstarch that I wanted to ask you.
Is it a GMO cornstarch?
It's a GMO question.
Okay, no, that guy's like following me around to every radio show. It's weird.
Okay, well, if you've covered it elsewhere, then we don't have to get
into it. I didn't cover it, actually.
Do you want to hear the question?
Ahead.
Okay,
sure.
You probably know what it is, but it says, cornstarch is a highly processed byproduct of the non-organic GM-friendly corn industry, right up there with such sinners as high fructose corn syrup. Why do you call for cornstarch so much rather than other more natural thickening agents? Would you consider testing substitutes to see how they compare?
That's funny because I don't feel like I do.
I used arrowroot powder for the tofu bennies.
Yeah,
yesterday.
Like I don't feel like I'm always like cornstarch. There is organic cornstarch, and you can't be organic if you're GMO. So I would just say use the organic cornstarch. But a lot of times people are nitpicky about stuff. Like it was kind of funny, but I got this email about food coloring and beetles, and how can I do that? And the letter was, it was actually on my message boards too. It was a multi-pronged campaign. and how do you justify yourself? And first of all, the red food coloring isn't from beetles. So that was funny in itself. I'm not going to put vegan in front of everything or organic in front of everything. There's going to be an ingredients list, and usually in the front of the book, we take a lot of time and effort to explain some of the ingredients. So I think most of the nitpicky letters come from people that, you know, want to be like that. So, like, this cornstarch guy, just use organic cornstarch. I do call for tapioca powder or arrowroot, sometimes specifically if there's something. So the rest of the question I wouldn't really even bother with. But, you know, and I also talk about how to sub things. Okay. So a lot, I can't, you know, I'm not going to be, like, a perfect human being.
What?
So.
Get off our radio show.
I know, bye.
So, I can't believe,
you know,
this is probably.
But I do try to be a perfect human being, so there is information about how to sub starches.
I don't know. I don't envy your position in some ways, because I know there's so many issues when you're talking about food, right? And to do food
at the top.
Yeah. We only have a couple more minutes left. It's I feel sad that this will probably be the last time I interview you, but maybe I'll come back and guess. Carl's going to take over the program, so certainly he will probably be talking to you in the future. But yeah, in the last few minutes, if there's anything that you wanted to share about the book, if there's a particular recipe that you've been really enjoying lately or you want to direct people towards, and maybe give people your website or any information that you'd like to pass on.
I actually, when we were talking about how veganism is going to save the world, I also want to add that it's a really affordable way to eat, and I think that's the other way. I think with the economic stuff going on, it's a really good time to start showing people how to cook with bulk grains and beans and things like that. So I just wanted to finish my veganism is going to save the world spiel in some articulate way.
Okay.
but yeah, I don't think there's anything else I need to add.
What about, you know, you obviously work so hard on these cookbooks and have so many favorites, and there's a real enthusiasm in the books. I loved reading through Veganomicon, too. It's a great pleasure to read as well as to cook from. But do you have one recipe that you may want to talk about or mention go into Vegan Brunch?
Well, a lot of people seem to be doing the tofu puttanesca, the scramble. So I would say that one's good. And we were talking a little bit about stuff that takes longer to make. There are a lot of easy recipes in there also, and less challenging recipes. So I think the tofu puttanesca is pretty simple. Puttanesca is like a capery, olive-y kind of sauce. So, yeah, I would say that one with just start roasting potatoes. You look at that recipe and you think, oh, this is roasted potatoes, no biggie. But if you roast potatoes right, it's just this level of heaven you can't normally reach. So I'd say those two would be a nice start.
Great. Thanks, Issa.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's been great interviewing you over the years, and I really have enjoyed.
You'll have to tell me where you're going.
Yeah, I got a professor gig at Brock University, and they're starting a critical animal studies
program.
So yeah, I'm actually get to teach animal stuff, which is really cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so I'm excited about it, but I think I'll probably come back and guest host.
Cool.
So anyway, thanks so much for coming on, and we can't wait to see what you'll do in the future. It's obvious that you're very busy. I should let people know that if you've tuned in halfway through or just catching us now, we're speaking today with Isa Chandra Moskowitz, talking about a book out by DeCapo Press called Vegan Brunch. And Isa, thanks again.
Thanks, Lauren and Carl.
Okay. Bye. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now coming up, we have Dos Mundos. Thanks, Carl, for teching. Please stay tuned. This is going to be a great show, as always, with Sergio.